this is Dr. Amy Myers, and welcome to our latest episode of the Myers Way podcast. Today, I am excited, as I always say about my guests, but I am very, very excited and looking forward to this interview probably more than many of the others. I have Dr. Peter D'Amo, and hopefully I'm saying that correctly. If not, you can correct me, who is the author of Eat Right for Your Blood Type, which was, still is, a New York Times bestseller. I remember when it came out on the market about in 1996, he has sold over 7 million copies, and it's in over 50 different languages around the world, and it's still having success on the New York Times bestseller. So please welcome Peter.
Hi, Amy. Thank you for having me.
Awesome. I'm so glad you're here. So we were kind of talking right before this just about the book and you know, differences in diet. So I'm looking forward to this conversation today. I wanted to start just by asking you how you really came up with this theory for the book Eat Right for Your Blood Type.
Well, I inherited the preliminary basis of the theory from my father, James D'Adamo, also a naturopathic doctor. Very inquiring mind. Back in the 1950s, he simply struggled with his observations that despite the fact that he tried a variety of different diets, there never seemed to be one diet that appeared to basically answer all the questions in all the patients. And so, in a really an interesting insight, given the fact that we're talking about the 1950s, he thought basically that blood groups, at least, are something that is a distinct physiological difference between people that he could measure. And so he proceeded to blood group people in his practice, and he kind of twiddled with the diets this way and that. And he came up with the crux of the observation, which is that there's, you know, a wide spectrum of possibly beneficial types of diets for people. And any work devoted to proving the supremacy of any one dietary theory is pretty much a wasted effort, because you'll find a significant number of people who perhaps will thrive on sometimes the exact opposite, diametrical diet. And so we came up with this characterization. He found type O's, for instance, did better on high protein. Type A's did better on what you would now call more of a Mediterranean type diet. And, you know, right then and there, when you're talking about the two genes, basically, that make you either an A or an O, you're talking about, you know, 88% of the world. So it's a very simple, very cost-effective signpost that basically kind of says, okay, you might look in this direction. However, you guys over here might want to look in a different, might want to explore a different way of doing things.
And I love that, because what I practice, you know, in my clinic is that there is no one right diet for everybody. And you got to figure out what's the right diet for you. And, you know, it's also why, I don't know why there's so many people out there, you know, somebody's a vegan and somebody's paleo and they're at these odds with one another. And it's like, well, that actually may be the right diet for them. And the paleo might be the right diet for the other person.
And the other person might, you know, have the wrong diet. I used to just get a kick out of when you sometimes watch Larry King and he'd have Ornish and Atkins on there and they'd be going at each other's throats. You know, but the reality of the whole thing is that actually anytime you get doctrinaire about something, it never gets back down to the patient. It's always about the theory. And so you spend all your time trying to shoehorn the patient and their observations and their reactions to the theory. Really, it's supposed to be the other way around. We're supposed to be actually shoehorning the theory to our observations and the reflections of the patient clinically. That's really the way you sort of do personalized medicine. You don't just sit there and ram a person into your particular theory. And that's really what's been the liability with things like the extreme type diets and extreme paleo or extreme vegan, is that the solution to a person who's not enjoying great results is to simply say you're not doing it good enough. And that's just not a very acceptable solution, especially for people who try very hard. And I mean, how hard do you have to try in order to get something to work is kind of a question that people need to ask more as well.
Well, I remember when your book came out and I picked it up and, you know, I'm reading it and I'm an O. And so it's telling me, you know, I need to be eating red meat. And at the time, I'm a vegetarian. And I'm thinking, this is ridiculous. I mean, I gave up meat at age 14. And this is, you know, this just not, I mean, I wasn't thinking it was hogwash, but I'm thinking, I can't do this. This is exactly the opposite of what I should be eating. Well, autoimmune thyroid disease later, and, you know, adrenal fatigue and all kinds of things. Here I am basically at a paleo and an eat right for your blood type diet.
A very common tale. You know, we used to collect outcomes on my website. Just simple people come in, tell their story, and correlated, you know, did you have any blood results before and after? And if they did, they would include those. Most common observation was, as far as pathology goes, was autoimmune thyroiditis corrected in type O's, for instance, who followed the type O diet. And all this time, I've always thought it was about the gut, because most of the autoimmune thyroiditis I'm aware of really comes from dysbiosis and just a lot of bizarre kind of dynamics with regard to the gut barrier. Really nice in terms of, you know, the idea that, I mean, I can understand being dubious of this theory, because when I first kind of talked to my father about it, he didn't really have much of a basis to it. It was just his observations. I was in school at the time, and what I had learned was what everyone else learns about blood groups, which is that, you know, they screw up transfusions. And so you should learn these relationships in the event that somebody gets a reaction, you know, terrible things happen. But nobody else really looked at, okay, what are the phenotypic things that occur because of your blood type besides, you know, something on an erythrocyte? And I was surprised because at the time I was getting ready to make a kind of a dissertation, I guess it was, a kind of a final paper. And I thought, okay, I'll go and march over to the University of Washington and see what's in the literature and see, oh, well, are there any diseases that correlate to blood groups? And do these diseases correlate to some of the things that he might be intimating could be avoided by adopting that certain type of diet? And I mean, surprising, there's a huge literature on diseases that are differ by the ABO blood groups. I mean, they've written entire textbooks on this. And a considerable number of them have to do with cardiovascular and digestive elements and immunological elements as well. So, I mean, there's no shortage of observances of where blood groups have different evolutionary patterns with regards to disease development. And one could argue that this is represents, at least we do in our own clinic here at the University of Bridgeport, is that we are taking advantage of these basic distinct phenotypic differences to engineer much more customized treatments. And, you know, we can talk about that as we go on. But I have to admit that, I mean, at the time that I was evaluating my father's observations, I thought there was ludicrous as people who would pick up my book and say, this is ridiculous. This is an erythrocytic antigen. How can that have anything to do with your diet?
Well, and so can you explain that to us? I mean, what really is it based on? I mean, what, you know, how did he even come up with this thought? I mean, how did he pick which foods would go with which blood type?
He just empirically just tried different diets with people and kept track of essentially who was coming back. And, you know, the great thing about these types of things, you know, when you're working with people, and this is an interesting observation I've actually noticed as well, and patients have as well, that oftentimes when a person adopts a diet through a philosophical predilection or an idea about ethical behavior, or perhaps maybe they're attracted to some aspect of the theory that, you know, want to be a caveman or something like that, they may or may not get it right. But when a person actually has a chronic disease that they've lived with for a very long time, and they adapt their diet in more in accordance to the strictures of these blood group characterizations, they often will come in and say that, you know, they've kind of almost on their own evolved towards the appropriate blood group diet, using their disease as a barometer. So most people who have any kind of relationship to the things that make their disease state wax and wane oftentimes will bumble into something that closely resembles the diet that would have been predicted by their blood group.
Interesting. Yeah, I mean, that's what I found. And I mean, that is definitely what I'm seeing clinically. You and I were talking before we started recording just about how, at least in my clinic, I can very much speak to those. I mean, me personally, but with my patients as well. I know on your website, I saw some information that bees were more common to have autoimmune. I see actually in my office, definitely autoimmune thyroid with the O's, but autoimmune in general with O's. So I don't know if you can speak to that.
Well, there's aspects to ABO which really are, I mean, it's ABO is the 800-pound gorilla of blood groups. Every other blood grouping system dwarfs in comparison to ABO, because ABO is found, in addition to being on erythrocytes, it's found composing all the mucus lining and glycosylation aspects of the gut. It controls many aspects of endoplasmic reticulum protein folding and glycosylation that occurs in the Golgi apparatus. It controls a lot of aspects with regards to gene linkages that are associated with the outcome of ABO, then tying into other unrelated functions but are controlled by the outcome of ABO. So it's a big locus. It's an interesting thing. It occupies a very discrete place on chromosome number 9, which is odd because if you look at the amount of staining that that particular chromatin band gets, it's very, very dense, which is unlikely to be the result of simply the fact that there's an allele that codes for two enzymes and a knockout. So there's a lot of stuff we don't know about the nature of how ABO actually controls other unrelated physiological events simply by the outcome of the ABO allele choice or the natural selection that's involved. An interesting thing is some of them have to do with things like stress, some have to do with things like relationships to nitric oxide production varies by blood groups. So there's other things we're still learning that are just completely independent of how we would have understood this to be the consequences, the downstream consequences of ABO, because gene linkage and epistatic relationships, and I don't know if the listeners understand that what epistatic is, but epistatic is how the outcome of one gene, in other words, the product of one gene actually then influences the expression of the other genes that are downstream of that product. So it's a case where gene goes to phenotype, and then phenotype itself starts to regulate subsequent elements of other genomic consequences. And a lot of that is under the control of ABO as well. So ABO is a big, big blood type in terms of things. I mean, you can find easily many pieces of evidence where it complicates things way beyond transfusions. You can't transplant organs without factoring in ABO. We also know that it's a major influence on just about all the secretions in the body as well. And that brings me to the second blood type that I think we should introduce at this point, which is the notion of secretor status. You know, it's normally the case when somebody talks about their blood type, they say, well, I'm A positive or I'm A negative. And everybody seems to think that those two things happen together. But of course, we physicians know that really you're specifying two independent blood groups. You're specifying ABO and you're specifying rhesus. Well, probably more clinically significant, since how many people are basically going to have a rhesus incompatible situation clinically, we should be putting right next to ABO, secretor, non-secretor, because that particular outcome is a phenomenally more significant in a clinical sense than rhesus will ever be. And all that secretor and non-secretor actually mean is that the person either does or does not have the ability to secrete their blood type, their ABO blood type, in their secretions. So it kind of starts out like this. All of us can put our ABO blood group antigens on erythrocytes and put them on certain types of tissues. But 80% of us can actually put our blood type in our secretions in a free-floating form, an unbound form. So 80% of us could be blood type from a perspiration stain or from a semen sample or from a vaginal smear or from a bit of digestive juice. We are so-called secretors of our ABO type. 20% of us actually are so-called non-secretors. They're missing the particular enzyme that's the result of a gene knockout, so that they can only make bound versions of their ABO blood type. It can only be bound to the membranes, bound to the cells, bound to the membrane barriers or whatever. This 20% are known as non-secretors. I mean, you know, the names are not terribly original. Secretors, non-secretors. If you've ever watched any of those Hannibal Lecter movies, they sometimes will talk about being a secretor or something like that. It comes up in forensic medicine because obviously if you can get a blood group, you know, from a rape victim out of the semen, it's the criminal would then obviously a secretor since it's in a secretion.
Right.
Well, 80% of the world has the blood group embedded in these secretions because many of these secretions are part of the mucosal defenses, and most of the mucosal defenses are involved in some intimate relationship with the biome. So when you look at the vaginal tract or you look at the mouth, you're looking at saliva or vaginal fluids. When you look at gut mucus, you're looking at all complex fluids that are rich in a variety of what are known as glycoconjugates, the main significant glycoconjugate being the ABO antigen or the ABH antigen. So blood group in 80% of the world has a massive influence at all the interfaces where we exist with the biome.
Wow.
And actually, even more interesting are the people who have the knockout, because they have such a distinctly different microbiome that it's now coming to the forefront that this 20% of non-secretors way over-monopolized the diseases that are associated with dysregulation of the microbiome. Crohn's disease. They have difficulty being able to assimilate vitamin B12. Major differences with regard to the elements of the kind of primordial gut strains. They have lower levels of secretory IgA in the gut. They have much more inflammatory reactions. So here's the answer to the question, what your observance is a type O, is that if you take those two markers and sort of triangulate off of them, you will find that the 20% of the population that are non-secretors, of which 40% will be type O. So we're really talking about what's 20% of 40%? It's about 8%. 8 to 10% of the people who are non-secretors are going to way overly monopolize the autoimmune spectrum in terms of your patient population. These are the patients who oftentimes come in with the masks and they got the environmental sensitivities, they got yeast overgrowth. You know, there's such an abundant literature on this that, you know, I wrote a textbook on it a while back, and it's still... It's not even, you know, it's something that you would say is something that at this particular point, we're just trying to get it into the naturopathic curriculum. And it's just such a basic, you know, pathophysiology. And I think the reason being is that a lot of people think, like, you know, ABO is kind of like old hat. It's very simple, you know, it can't be that complicated. Let's go look at SNPs and let's go look at haplogroups because they're just a whole lot more sexy. But the reality is ABO gives you a massive amount a phenotypic distinction right then and there. You like turn left, turn right.
And so how does one determine if they're secretor or not?
There's a couple of ways. The traditional way was to go and take some saliva and do what's known as an antibody inhibition test on the saliva. I won't bore the listeners with it, but the idea being is that if a person who's got antigen in their saliva, if you introduce some antibody to the antigen, their own antigen will soak up the antibody. Mm-hmm. And then adding subsequent erythrocytes of that person's ABO blood type would lead to no reaction. Mm. On the other hand, if the person was a non-secretor, the antibody would have nothing to bind to in the saliva, which meant that when you introduced reagent red blood cells as the person's ABO type subsequent to that, the unbound antibody would have something to react to, so you would see a different reaction. That's why it's known as antibody inhibition. So it gets more complicated.
I was going to say, because I would think, just intuitively thinking, that the secretors would have more health issues because they're secreting and interacting with that environment rather than the non-secretors.
You know, it's interesting. It in a way, you could kind of almost think that, but think about it from a terrarium standpoint. You know, I've got this swirling mess of food particles, blood group antigens, bacteria, and all sorts of intermediate byproducts in my intestinal tract. And I've got a whole variety of bad things, perhaps, that would love to do nothing more than attach to my mucosa and initiate infection. It could be H. pylori, it could be cryptosporidium, it could be giardia. The vast majority of microorganisms are ABO-specific in terms of their attachments, which have to do with the chemicals known as lectins, which we'll get into in a little while. Most bacteria and viruses attach to the mucosa because they have a protein that attaches to the glycans on the mucosal surface. It's kind of a lock and key thing.
Right.
And many of those glycans are ABO specific. So it's not that surprising that a lot of the most common infectious diseases have a specificity for one blood group or another. So I'm going to just throw that in the mix. Now we've got bad bacteria. We've got all these food debris. We've got lectins from the diet that are coming in from beans and legumes and grains. What do you think would be the outcome if I said to you, well, in the midst of all this, all these things are trying to attach to me, so I'm making all this unbound fake me flying around.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's like chafe. You know, in the Army, when they don't want you to see the plane on the radar, they drop pieces of aluminum foil.
Yeah.
And, you know, so it's like a cloaking device. So people who are secretors have much more expression of blood group in their intestinal tract, which means two things. It's going to steer them and towards a microbiome that is rich in bacteria that prefer to degrade that blood group. So many bacteria will take blood group antigens and actually incorporate them into their energy production cycle. Work was done in the 70s by a guy named Hotchkiss, who showed that there were strains of bacteria that are 50,000 times higher in certain blood groups than in others in terms of their concentration. And, you know, now the biome is the talk of the, you know, medical world, because
right,
we're seeing
yeah.
associations with rheumatoid arthritis just came up recently, all sorts of other things. Well, it turns out that the vast majority of Crohn's disease sufferers are basically in that non-secretor category. So there's a disadvantage there. If you've got, you're eating reactive foods, or you have reactive bacterial strains that are secreting any sort of, you know, soluble components, endotoxin, or any sort of hemagglutinins, when you're a non-secretor of your blood type, there's no fake blood type to get them all mixed up. You know, when they latch on to your blood group, they get the real person.
Right.
So they have, but you know, it's interesting. Evolution is a very profound way of balancing the scales, you know. It's sort of like they have other things that kind of are supposed to sort of help out there. So there's, it's interesting that you can't, and I find this again and again, my temptation is to find something right and something wrong in these blood group distinctions or in these secretor distinctions. And many times it's not a question of right or wrong. It may appear there initially when you have an observance that says, oh, look, there's an association that shows that A secretors get more of this. And then you think, well, that's bad. But then you maybe learn a little bit more and you realize that that perhaps the other side of the coin has some trade-off with regard to some other benefit that they derive from that as well. So most of the time when you add things up, they sort of come out pretty much the same on both sides of the equal signs. You know, A's get more of this and O's get more of that. We talked about inflammation. It's been known in the literature that O's tend to get more of the inflammatory joint things. That's been known since the 60s. You know that, for instance, O non-secretors, 20% of the population who are non-secretors who are type O, they have much more of, it's an interesting dichotomy, they carry much more candida in their body, and they're much more inclined to have allergic reactions to it.
Yeah.
So it's an interesting kind of thing. And then you start looking at, okay, candida, type O, thyroid. And what's the thing that all of that has in common?
Mercury.
The sugar fucose.
Oh, I was going to say heavy metals as well, detoxification from heavy metals, but that's
well, that
a whole
wouldn't
other
necessarily
issue.
Be a blood type thing.
Right. Well, yeah. It's more MTHFR.
Yeah. So you look at blood group. Now, what's the antigen for type O fucose? What's the attachment point for candida? Fucose. Turns out that actually even related to thyroid, a lot of the things, what's the thing that we often use in herbal medicine for thyroid? Fucus, bladderwrack, because it's so rich in fucose. So in many respects, you can see that so many of the deeper relationships actually exist not at the genome level, not at the epigenetic level, but with blood group, they exist at the epiglycemic level, the level where epigenetics and glycomics comes together to determine phenotype. And so you see significance with regards to blood groups in terms of cancer, in terms of evolution of cancer cells, or de-evolution, if you choose to use that phrase. In terms of inflammatory things, a lot, we said there's such links between protein glycosylation and protein misfolding, which now we're understanding to be, again, another primordial influence on chronic inflammation and degenerative disease, misfolded proteins and inadequate chaperoning of the misfolded proteins back to a properly folded form, something called unfolded protein response and endoplasmic reticulum stress, which is what happens when the cells wind up with misfolded proteins inside of their Golgi. It stimulates a whole apoptosis reaction, so the cell has to either activate chaperones to put the proteins back into a properly folded form, or the apoptosis pathway is activated and the cell goes through an apoptosis cycle. And most people don't realize it, but the vast majority of the steroids in this world basically are given to blunt the unfolded protein response. Most of the time when a person takes a steroid for a medical condition, they're taking it because the condition is characterized by endoplasmic reticulum stress from misfolded proteins. Many of the evolution of these misfolded proteins are blood group specific as well.
And so back to the secretors, is there, I thought I saw something on one of your websites, do you have a way for people to more easily test if they're a secretor or not?
There is another way to do it in the blood. So if the physicians are interested in doing this, you can run a separate blood grouping test called the Lewis B antigen. And if you use Quest like we do or one of the other tests, you're probably going to have somebody say, what the hell is that? But then just go tell them to call down to blood banking and they'll know what you're talking about. It's about, labs vary considerably on this test. It could be anywhere from $50 to $60 to $70. And what you're testing for is another blood group called the Lewis system. And you're testing for the Lewis B antigen. In other words, you're testing for the whether or not the person is capable of making the Lewis B antigen. To make a long story short, the ability to make your blood type occur in a free soluble form and the ability to make Lewis B are both controlled by the same gene, FUT2, fucosyl transferase 2. So you could use the outcome of this simple other blood grouping test to determine Lewis B status to impute secretor status. You get the outcome of that if the person comes back Lewis B positive, you're pretty much certain that they're an ABO secretor. If it comes back Lewis B negative, it means that they were missing the ability to create Lewis B from Lewis A because they didn't have the same gene that other people use to become a secretor, FUT2. They can't convert Lewis A to Lewis B, so Lewis B is not there. So you can use this as a very simple test. If a person comes back Lewis B positive, they're a secretor. If it comes back Lewis B negative, they're a non-secretor.
Awesome. I'm going to start doing that.
You can, believe it or not, you can get the outcome of the FUT2 test from on the 23andMe panel.
Yeah, well, so we have this whole, in fact, I'll invite you to our group where I'm part of a journal club of which Todd Lapine is also part of. And we have this massive discussion going back and forth, including, I believe, the director of the 23andMe about are these things accurate or not because of how they actually run the test. I mean, it's been just emails back and forth. It's been quite incredible. I can forward some of them to you.
Great, because, you know, the other thing, of course, too, is that, you know, there are genomic ways, microarray analysis that could do this.
Yeah, well, what they're doing, and, it, you know, it's too complex, and I haven't been reading all of the emails lately, but, you know, because they're trying to do it on such a large scale, the way that they run that as opposed to, you know, a lab like Metametrics or Genova or something like that, they're running it on a much smaller scale, and so it's sort of like having a computer chip scan for differences versus, you know, a person there or, you know, individually looking for the difference.
So, sure. I get that.
Yeah. So there's apparently potentially some vast amount of error rate on that. But, yeah, no, since I can do this through a regular lab, and then is there information on your site about, I'm imagining that there are differences in diets between the secretors and the non-secretors?
My second book, which was the follow-up to Live Right, I'm sorry, was follow-up to Eat Right, was called Live Right. And that book has a very extensive part of it devoted to secretor status. So most people are familiar with Eat Right, for better or worse, because it was a phenomenal seller. The second book I wrote after that called Live Right, I think is perhaps maybe the book I'm the mass market book I'm most proud of, because I think it was the one that was the broadest. I had the liberty, unlike with my first book, of being able to actually explore things in a much more fact-based scientific way. You know, mass market books are you're seriously hamstrung when it comes to being able to tell a story that is going to make your critics happy, because they're trying to make some guy with a sixth grade education in Barnes & Noble happy.
Right.
So the reality is that, you know, the Eat Right book, phenomenal success. But I think a lot of people make a mistake and think that that is all they need to know about things, which is seriously wrong because, you know, I mean, it just is the way it is. When you have a book that sells that many copies, that's a testimony to its accessibility.
Right.
And when you're writing a book that's accessible, you're going to have to kind of produce the more, what shall I say, the more comic book version of things, because you have to basically be able to maintain somebody's attention span who's not a scientist. And a lot of the more sort of trivial commentary on it that comes from various people with skin in the game always seem to be based on looking at that book. It seems like they never want to go any further than that book, which is kind of seriously, I don't know. Doesn't show a whole lot of curiosity, if you ask me.
Yeah, and I'm over here just salivating about, you know, wanting to read them all now, because I even saw on your website last night you have one, you know, Change Your Genetic Destiny, and I was looking at that. I'm like, I'm definitely a hunter. As I was reading, you know, through all the characteristics, I was like, this is just, it's so cool.
So, you know, I can tell you that my career in medicine has gone now into three different phases. I guess the first phase I call adjusting people to genes, which is characterized by the phenomenal success of the work that I did with blood groups. Very fast, you know, consumer friendly, easy enough. Find your blood type, look it up on page so-and-so, and away you go. And in roughly around 2003 or 2004, I was reading an article that, of all things, was about blood groups and ear infections. And the interesting thing about the article was not that there was an association between blood groups and ear infections. There was an association between getting a recurrent ear infection in your first year of life with not your blood group, but your mother's blood group. So I thought to myself, wow, that's an intergenerational effect of this type of phenotypic expression. But Amy, here's where it gets even more interesting. The relative risk, the RR, on the quality of this association was a little bit over 29. A 29 RR is equivalent to saying that it's 2,900% more likely that this association is true than false.
Right.
The relative risk that you will get heart disease from having elevated homocysteine is 1.3. And here's an association that's 29.
Right.
Linking ear infections in kids to their mother's blood type. So I thought to myself, I've got to basically start thinking about where I'm looking at intergenerational effects that are going to be controlled by things like blood groups. This is back in 2003, 2004. Nobody knew what the word epigenetics was. And transgenerational, if you put it on Google, you got a psychiatrist who specialized in treating mothers and daughters.
Oh, I thought you were going to tell me that it even got you something about like transgender people or something.
I suppose it would, because nobody was thinking in these terms. That we had some ideas of thrifty phenotype or 350 genotype, but the reality that we had is post-genomic gene control. Everybody was still genuflecting to the genome and what Frick called the central dogma, that everything goes downstream from the genome and nothing ever goes back up again. Well, of course, now everybody's epigenetics is like the weather. Everybody talks about it, but nobody can do anything about it. There are nutritional influences that are known to be epigenetic. But at a certain point, I started thinking that, and I was basing this off the work of a guy named Conrad Waddington, who was an embryologist who actually coined the phrase epigenetics back in the 50s. And Waddington said that actually epigenetics is where an organism goes through a what he called an epigenetic landscape, where basically there were valleys and hills, and phenotype would be like a ball rolling through the valleys. And every time it would roll into one valley, it was constrained and could only go into subsequent sub-valleys of that valley. And this has pretty much been the model of how we develop as organisms, you know, through the efficacy of things like our genome. But our genome turns out to be not terribly important. We have a lot of genes, not as many as other creatures actually thought to be much simpler than us. And many of our genes can be read multiple ways. So that explains why, in many ways, we don't have as many genes as an earthworm, and that our genes can be read different ways. We can get a recipe for peanut butter cookies out of a recipe for chocolate chip peanut butter cookies, and we do that better than most other species. But the reality is that actually it's still the morphogenetic patterning that occurs through the evolution of phenotype that acts as the major constraints. There's no gene that says this is where your liver begins and this is where your spleen ends. There's nothing genomically that determines the architecture as far as we can tell. That's all done through how actually the evolution of phenotype extends through this plasticity phase, and the various gradients of things are been programmed so that when a certain cell gets to a certain gradient, we know that we're getting towards the end of the organ, so maybe it's time to make some parenchyma. So it turns out that there's a lot of developmental aspects that have these sort of non-pure genetic ways. And then I decided that I was talked earlier on about epistasis, how phenotype can control subsequent genotype. And there's a lot of epistatic relationships that exist between things like finger length and lower leg length to upper leg length, even the longitudinal and vertical axes of the cranium. All of these things represent indexes that represent differences in developmental trajectories. And many of them are linked to other things like blood group or secretor status. So the idea of taking them all and putting them together and then doing a statistical analysis to see if they coalesced in certain areas – that would almost seem to define those valleys that Waddington talked about. Were there knowable valleys that seem to, you know, not everybody gets a unique valley. We obviously do a lot of things like each one of the, like every one of us does. We all have 10 fingers, we all have one head. So maybe there were certain types of patterns. And so I spent like about 2 or 3 years doing all this statistical stuff and coming up with how certain types of things seem to come together as part of developmental trajectories. And much of these things, again, didn't take me very far away from blood groups, because maybe the prime reason we still have blood groups is that they are so critical to germ cell development in the early parts of our lives. It's probably the reason that they're still there. So I then wound up with these, what I call epigenotypes, which are these kind of characterizations that kind of have some elements of blood group, but also some elements of anthropometrics and some elements of generalized formulas for fitness, such as asymmetry. And there was some work I did with fingerprints. It all got integrated into a statistical package, and it could be computed, and then diets could be generated from this. So that led to this book. So now all of a sudden I went from phase one of my life, where it was just the patient to the gene, to phase two of my life, where it was adjust the gene to the patient. Mm-hmm. Okay, so now I got, then I did that for a while. And then about 2 or 3 years ago, it manifested in a program called SWAMI, which basically we use at the COE to generate these complex one-of-a-kind diets. It's really, really zip right down to a whole lot of things you could never do unless you had, you know, reasonable computing power. And now in the third stage of my life, I'm sort of into this what's called generative paradigm. And that is the notion that we can study complex web-like relationships mathematically so as to understand the points where they can be best controlled to maximize our outcomes, and to not necessarily pursue them from a reductionist standpoint, but from a more systems biology integrated way. And so the University of Bridgeport, this is what we do as well. Again, using computers, and again, using network analysis and mathematics, we pull a person apart as a web of interlocking parts and put them all back together again. So it's all been an extension of this whole thing. And eventually, as I said before, now I'm trying to teach this to the next generation of medical students, and kind of gets us back to the idea the naturopaths had of the, you know, the vis, you know, the sort of self-organizing principle in the body that is engendered, you know, to restore and heal. And, you know, to look at that as an emergent phenomenon. An emergence is kind of this idea that complex systems can generate big jumps in significance that are unanticipatable by looking at the parts that are interlocking to produce them. So this is what I think is the next frontier. So in a way, this generative model, I think, is what a lot of people look for when they use the term functional. It's just that ultimately the generative capacity is that you're kind of looking at a distinct avoidance of cause and effect.
And so how can, you know, someone like myself who's interested in this type of work get, I mean, is your program, the SWAMI, available to other people? Is that only if it's a patient of yours, or?
No, other physicians use it routinely.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, I can give you a URL at some point, and your listeners can go read about it.
Okay.
It's actually rather, I mean, I write a lot of software. This morning I write software even when I don't have software to write. It's just the way I am. But, you know, now we're looking at actually developing these web-like bases of physician interactions over there. And actually the best thing, people want to learn more about the generative things, which will also carry into epigenetics and carry into the much more technical aspects of blood group. They should go to generativemedicine.org, and under the pull down for education, just pull down the thing that looks at textbooks, and they can. I wrote a 800 or 900 page textbook that basically is the fundamentals of this new field, and it's all the epigenetics is there, all the glycomics is there, all the polymorphisms are there, all the standard things, you know, the SNPs and all the other nuclear factors and all that kind of stuff, but also too to talking about complex systems, complex adaptive systems, and how what's known as combinatorics, the study of the mathematics of the geography of webs, can be applied to molecular networks. And if somebody would like to see that in action, they can go to a website that I put together that has a variety of different molecular pathway analysis tools. It's called DataPunk, datapunk.net. So it's datapunk.net. And they can click on programs and they can explore molecular maps from anything from adipocytokine to apoptosis to Warburg to hormesis. And these are very sophisticated molecular maps because unlike PEG or Reactome, these maps are dynamic, meaning that is anything, the maps rearrange depending upon what we add or subtract from them. And actually the maps contain information on things like herbs and vitamins that are known to influence the expression of the entities in the map. So it's really the first integrated molecular maps that contain references to natural products as well.
And that's all, you know, really interesting, and there, I'm sure, listeners out there that are going to go and do that, and many of my listeners are really often looking for kind of practical advice as well. So if someone's interested in this, what would be their first step? Obviously knowing their blood type, and then probably it sounds like the book is good and a good place to start, but really not fully adequate. So learning their secretor status.
Not for a physician, Amy. A physician should in no way think that eat right for your type suffices for an education in this polymorphism. It's a terrific tool for the patient, though.
Right. And knowing their secretor status, I mean, it sounds like between those two, that's a good place for people to start.
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, if physicians want to take it further, there's any number of resources I've written over the years. There's if they go to the main website that I've put together, which is just my last name, so it's dadamo.com, D-A-D-A-M-O.com, they should be off to the races. I mean, that website has been up for almost 20 years. There are links there that just go to the most in-depth discussions of things. And then there's message boards where people want to know how come they can't have sweet potatoes.
Yeah, well, that's actually a question, not the sweet potatoes, but, and maybe this has more to do with the secretor status, but, you know, the O's are supposed to be more paleolithic type diet with the meats and whatnot, and when I was looking at the list, you know, eggs, avocados, and coconut, and those typically, at least the avocados and coconuts, are big in the paleo world, so can you talk a little bit about that, of what the issue is with those foods and the O's?
It's not so much the foods themselves, but oftentimes they interact with other foods. So, and this, of course, is the other problem we have in modern nutrition. Everybody basically puts on the binoculars and looks at one thing. This is good. This is bad. This is no good. This is a superfood. This is a terrible thing. Don't ever eat it. The reality is that with computers and big data, you can look at how foods interact together in the same meal. So in many respects, you could look at things that are able to influence the actions and effects of other things. Now, you have to realize, I mean, coconut oil in 1994 was a different thing than coconut oil in 2013. You know, coconut oil in 1994 was something they put on a Drake's cake.
Yeah.
All right? Now, people make better coconut oil, but the reality is that generally, in many respects, these types of medium chain fatty acids do often tend to cause reactions that make the proteins not as avid for the things that they should be reacting with. And so, you know, we try to limit it. But there are certain subtypes. I mean, you had mentioned that, was there a secretor version to that? But yes, the truth is once you know your secretor status, you can take it one more level in depth. And there are elements of secretor status that kind of allow the use of these types of oils a little bit more freely. Avocado, many foods are there because of their interactivity with blood groups, and that's through the lectins that they possess. And avocado sometimes has effects of inhibiting certain types of absorption that's supposed to take place in the salivary tract. So, you know, many of these things were tests that I did early in my career on combinations of foods and looking for whether or not there were other actions. I mean, the simplest thing you can do is drop a food on a slide and see if it agglutinates red blood cells. And then you've got a hemolytic lectin. But most of the reactions that lectins produce, They're not so straightforward. They don't produce a direct erythrocytic heme agglutination. Mostly what they do is they act to induce something called endocytosis. Endocytosis is basically one of 150 pathways by which something can get pulled from inside your gut to into your lymphatics and bloodstream across your brush border membrane and your mucosa. And many of these lectins, even though they don't cause any direct heme agglutination, if you put them in combination with other things, they enhance the effect of endocytosis. So the person becomes more porous to other things through the effects of some of these foods. And that's basically where we kind of draw the line. There's, lectins are a very, very, I mean, we could talk for an hour on lectins. It's in a very robust area of nutrition that nobody, very few people pay any attention to.
Yeah, well, we definitely do here in my clinic. So just, you know, for the listeners, can you explain what they are and why they're so harmful or harmful to some?
Yeah, and actually they're helpful if you know what to do with them too. You can use lectins to do all sorts of cool things. What it is a lectin is a protein molecule that has a sweet tooth. So it's a lectin that likes to glom onto carbohydrates. Now, that's nothing special. Most proteins actually like to connect to carbohydrates. That's kind of why hormones have receptors. You know, receptors have lots of carbohydrate and hormones have almost no carbohydrate. So when the hormone binds to the receptor, it's because of the covalent attractive forces between the glycosylation on the receptor and the lack of glycosylation on the hormone. The thing about lectins is they don't have just a sweet tooth. They have a massive sweet tooth, that their clefts and binding sites are enormous. And so they are capable of binding to massive glycans, branching structures that have all sorts of unique, shall we say, stereo representations in three-dimensional space, and it's all very lock and key. You might have a lectin, for instance, in soybean that attaches to certain type of sugar. It's a version of something called GalNAc, N-acetylgalactosamine. And so there you go. You have a sugar and you have a lectin. They bond together. But the interesting thing is that most glycans, the branching of the glycans exists in three-dimensional space as well. And oftentimes the lectins are not only specific for the glycan, but they're specific to the orientation of the branching of the glycans. So they're phenomenally specific molecules. Not only do they bond to a specific glycan, they bond to a specific conformation of the glycan. Many of these differences in the conformation of glycans, amongst other things, are part of the process by which a cell goes on to display things like tumor antigenicity or aberrant glycosylation that would be characteristic of the inflammatory process. Much of the things we call inflammation are the end results of aberrant glycosylation. And we talked about that earlier when we talked about endoplasmic reticulum stress. So lectins can react with altered tissue that's a result of inflammation, and that can induce further inflammation. It can inhibit healing. On the other hand, lectins are known to agglutinate cancer cells because they can be specific for the altered glycosylation on the cancer cell, and many of those turn out to be blood group specific or tumor markers. Certain lectins actually can be used to produce to carry molecules through the mucosa. For instance, tomato has a lectin that they've conjugated to pharmaceuticals, and they get the pharmaceutical to pass through the buccal membrane. But most of the time, lectins are found in beans and grains and seeds, because a lectin is like a piece of Velcro, right? And the cells are sort of like an old beat-up tennis ball. So the lectin gloms onto the fuzz on the tennis ball, and often it interrupts the signaling of the cell, because many of these glycans on the surface are part of the receptor triggering for intracellular signaling, and some lectins are actually able to sort of cross-link cells, causing agglutination, which is how cells get stuck together. So you wind up with this agglutination reaction, you wind up with the induction of endocytosis, making the gut more permeable. You wind up with an activation of most of the pro-inflammatory states from dietary lectins. Many dietary lectins are very blood type specific. Not all of them, but many of them are. Many of them are able to induce dysbiosis or to repair dysbiosis. There is a lectin in the common mushroom that actually, if you give it to people who have polyps, actually you'll see their polyps actually over time actually reduce and eliminate because of the lectin specificity for a marker called Thompson-Friedreich antigen, which is one of the early antigens that's expressed by sort of pre-neoplastic cells in the colon. So there's lots of utility of these things, but why do we have lectins? And it really, the best example is that that these seeds are like embryos, you know, seeds and grains and grasses, they're all embryos. And the lectin is given oftentimes as part of the, I guess, evolution, because it essentially acts as a primitive immune system, right? Let's say you're some peanut in the ground, right? You nobody's going to give you bone marrow, right? Mm-hmm. So but you have fungus, right? You have aflatoxins and all sorts of things that grow on you. So what they did is, through evolution, they built up these inventory of lectins inside these grains and legumes to function as primitive antibodies until the seed can germinate.
Now, yes, my understanding is that it's mostly in the legumes and grains and nuts and seeds, but now you're saying that there's also some in tomatoes, and I think you alluded to it in avocado.
Yep, there's a considerable number of lectins in a variety of different vegetables and fruits, and there's even occasionally some lectins in muscle meats. For instance, Galus galus, the domestic chicken, has a lectin in it that actually is known to bond very aggressively to the B erythrocytic antigen, which is why on the blood group diets we tell people, if you're type B with inflammation, maybe you should knock off the chicken for a while. And the funny part is, then they go, okay, and then say, well, eat some turkey. They go, well, wait a minute, you know, isn't that the same thing? Nope. Lectins are extraordinarily glycan specific and extraordinarily species specific. Most of the, for instance, you have lectins in lentils that actually induce suppressor T cell activity. There's a lectin in stinging nettle that does something very similar. The wheat germ agglutinin lectin basically does the exact opposite. It actually induces inflammation. It induces inflammation in tissues that have already been altered by inflammation.
It just sounds overwhelming. I mean, it makes you scared to eat anything, right? Or take a supplement or anything?
Well, you know, I like to think that, when this is generative, you know, we measure a system's capacity as a network by virtue of its robust behavior. And robust behavior implies how relevant is that system? How immune is that system to perturbation? Perturbation is a part of life, okay? So a system that is fragile is susceptible to perturbation. And fragility can come from a variety of different ways. For instance, this is something we need to talk about in alternative medicine, because the best way to induce fragility in a complex system is to over-anticipate its needs. So when we sit there and give somebody something to somebody and we say, that's good for you, we're really running the risk, if persisted long enough, of actually increasing the fragility of the system.
Right.
Or over-optimizing the system is another thing, you know. So being able to actually produce a system that has better communication and better robust behavior results in a system that actually becomes anti-fragile. And that is actually a system that actually becomes stronger through perturbation, which takes you into the realm of like hormesis and some of that other theories. So what we want to do is not teach people to put themselves in a bubble. We want to induce better robust behavior so that the actual things that are detrimental to them make them further anti-fragile. And that is, again, generative in terms of what the word actually fundamentally implies.
And so what are the type of patients that you see? Are you typically seeing people who are very complex with cancers and autoimmune, or general population, or what types of people are coming to you?
Well, I guess I could say I see a little bit of everything, which is really the real delightful part of the whole thing. It ranges from, you know, metabolic issues to cancer to sometimes the only thing you're left to do is simply call it a dyscrasia, you know, some weird blood picture of this going that way and that going this way. I seem to get a lot of people with weird blood pictures. So it's a kind of a general practice, I would say. I mean, I like the generative capacity in oncology is a very unexplored area. So we do see a lot of people with those kind of problems.
And are most people local, or are they traveling because they've read your books and they're traveling to see you specifically?
Yeah, the reality is one out of every six people is local.
Mm-hmm.
Probably same with you.
Yeah, I would say probably half are in Texas, somewhere in Texas. Maybe a fourth are here in Austin, and then the rest are coming from, you know, all over. Mm-hmm. You know, there are just so few of us that really try to look at people as individuals and get down to the root. And are you using any of the sort of what we call functional tests, looking at the gut and looking at dysbiosis? Or are you really just using your model and changing, looking at the blood type and their secretors and your new SWAMI software to come up with the right diet, and then assuming that the gut and those things get back in alignment when you have the right diet for them?
It's a great question. I went through a phase when those kind of things seemed attractive. But they've fallen over by the wayside over the years because of two reasons. One, I'm a naturopath, and so a lot of people don't have coverage for things that I advocate. And so I tend to be much more conscious of the fact that I've got to be very careful about what I do and what I want to bring into this picture in terms of their own financial obligations. And number two, I found that most of those things still hadn't identified the same processes that I had identified much easier in my own ways. Mm-hmm. And it's not to take anything away from those tests, and people get wonderful results and use them, but a lot of people can tell you what they learned at John Bastier. I can tell you what I learned from John Bastier. Mm-hmm. I'm that old. And what Bastier used to say when we'd walk in and say, we want to do a so-and-so and this and that, he would look and shake his head. He goes, tests don't get people better. And I thought to myself, 20, 30 years later, it's still the same thing. If I have a process that person can start from today, and that today being their first visit, and then taking that process all the way through to something that maybe we ask them to come back in 2 or 3 months, if I had enough negative outcomes or poor returns and poor results, I would be very open to running a lot of those tests. But an inordinate number of people, and this is certainly testifiable by the huge number of students who pass through the generative medicine shifts in personalized medicine, most of these people never get to that point. The diets really fundamentally sort them out. And, it's like I said before, the thing that made me think about this in terms of the evolution from gene-based to epigenetic-based to epiglycemic, phenotype-based to generative, was the process of just trying to get further and further out of out of my own calculations and try to get to a point where I was discerning those kind of subtle forces and moving ambitiously and aggressively to work with those, no question of that, but trusting that this principle basically in and of itself will oftentimes be sufficient. The difficulty, as I said before, if we come up with a bunch of testing that's going to put a person with a glass of lemon water and a rice cracker, that's not going to be a robust system by the time we're done. Mm-hmm. It's going to be an overly fragile system, and we're going to be over anticipating way too much on the part of that person.
And so how long do you find, and obviously it's different depending on what someone's come in with, but if you're not doing testing and treating specifically an infection in the gut and you're using the diet and then allowing the body to naturally get back into alignment, how long does that process take? I mean, is there a, 3 months, 6 months, a year, 2 years?
No, I think 3 months is a pretty common time frame for a positive outcome. Mm-hmm. We'd be concerned if we weren't seeing changes in 3 months.
Right.
Again, it's people have different ways of deducing things, and people have different paradigms and clinical metaphors, and I'm just saying what works for me. And what I've learned is that this is teachable, and it's hard because you got to do a lot of thinking. But fortunately, look at our profession and ask yourself how much of functional medicine, alternative medicine, generative medicine, naturopathic medicine, holistic medicine is based on high informatically valuable calculations and conclusions. And I'm not talking about it in an abstract sense. I'm talking about the person living and breathing right in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
Not zero. Okay? So ultimately what we're left with is perhaps maybe a crude wisdom. I used this on the last person. That worked pretty good. This is what my teacher told me to do. Mm-hmm. This is what I read in a book. But we can do better than that. Basically you're looking at people and people like even our friend Todd, people are becoming, we can generate data and we can convert data into information. We can take information, convert it into knowledge, and we can take knowledge and convert it into wisdom. And you can do that by simply utilizing these notions of web-based relationships and generative strategies. And it's, you know, the Chinese have been doing this for only a couple of thousand years.
Right. So who are your, I mean, what do your biggest critics say about this? That it's just too simplistic, or that we've evolved since our blood type? I mean,
well, I mean, I could say that I haven't heard those things, but sad to say, I have.
Yeah.
The reality is, I don't think most of the phenotypic associations with blood group are certainly within the realm of the last 100,000 years. Although most people go, well, you know, the mutations that produce the ABO blood types are millions of years old, and they are. But most of the phenotypic correlations, disease associations, those have been engendered in the last 100,000 years.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting thing too is when we go, well, the classic one you used to hear from like people like Andrew Weil was like, well, you know, animals have blood types and they don't eat right for their blood type. And it's an interesting thought. If you would pursue it a little further, you could say a lot of interesting things about it. But the thing that is something that I know he doesn't is that actually blood groups have different effects in different species that are quite, quite extreme. One of the single biggest distinctions of aberrant glycosylation is interspecies differences, which is why you should never use a rat study to conclude that taking soybeans is bad for your thyroid, because rat thyroids glycosylate differently than humans. But to make a long story short, if I was a pig and I had blood group O, I would have a coat of black fur. Okay? Now, we know that people walking the planet, human beings with type O, they don't have black hair. So you can see that blood group occupies different phenotypic expression interspecies quite distinctly. So you can't use an argument, well, how come my dog doesn't eat right for his blood type? Because your dog probably doesn't have the same set of associations in his gut that you do. You know, so the end result is, although dogs are mostly type A and they get a lot of cancer, so maybe there is some associations.
Oh, really? Because I thought, you know, I would think that, that, you know, I feed my dog a grain-free diet and a raw diet. So maybe that's not the right thing. They need to be on a vegetable diet. These are the vegetarians,
you know,
right?
If only we had information that being a type A in a dog was the same as being a type A in a human.
Right.
Which we don't.
Right, we don't.
So my response was not that I had the answer to why animals don't eat right for their blood type. I'm just simply saying that the reality is that it's a ridiculous question, because blood type means different things in different species.
Right.
So that's a common criticism. The other one is, you know, a lot of it is people with skin in the game. You know, and welcome to the dog-eat-dog world with dietary mass-market books. I mean, you have a theory that says, well, maybe everybody's right, and everybody who has a book that says I'm right gets mad at you.
Yeah. It's just a shame that that even has to happen. I mean, you know, why can't it just be that nobody really knows and these are all opinions that, you know, certainly I personally have found help from following the Eat Right for Your Blood Type O type, and I use it with my patients, and I'm definitely going to be ordering this Lewis B antigen on myself and check that out, and that might be my next, you know, new lab test that I'm adding to, you know, do on. I literally, because of your book recently, when I change my diet, I now check everyone's blood type when they come in.
Do you know what a power law is?
No.
A power law is a mathematical formula that was developed by a mathematician named Pareto in Italy. And he came to the conclusion when he had done some work that he thought it was very odd that 20% of the Italians owned 80% of the real estate.
Oh, yeah.
And that became what's known as a Pareto distribution. And it applies to almost everything that has to do with networks. That, for instance, if you're in a particular company, a volunteer group, 20% of the volunteers will do 80% of the work, and 80% of the volunteers will do 20% of the work. Okay? The reason I'm bringing this up is that 20% of the population of the world are non-secretors, and they will have 80% of the illnesses that you're going to scratch your head, you're going to stamp the floor, and you're going to wish you had a back door on your clinic, because they're just the ones who are the most complex, difficult to get better, and the most likely to relapse. These are your super complex patients. So by doing the simple secretor test, you're able to identify the 20% of the population that's going to give you 80% of the headaches in your clinical practice.
So maybe we should screen before you come. You have to do this blood test before you can become a patient. I'm just kidding.
On the
I
other
like
hand,
the
let's,
complex
let's,
stuff. I mean, actually, I thrive off of the complex. So.
Oh. It's what makes practice interesting at the end of three decades. If it was just more cookbook stuff, I mean, you know, there's better things to do with what time we have left in this world.
Absolutely. I mean, I've told myself that, you know, when I stop learning, then, you know, I'll be done. It's sort of like these podcasts. When there's nobody else I want to interview, when I'm not learning things. But the sign of a good podcast is when I really learn something. And I think I learned more on this podcast than I have on all my others. So I definitely appreciate
it. I'm happy. It was just a very nice conversation with a very nice person to converse with.
Awesome. Well, the final question that I have for you that I typically ask everybody on my podcast, because so much does surround food, is what do you eat in a typical day?
I start off about 3:30 in the morning.
Oh my gosh.
My troglodyte existence takes me out to my office where I proceed to consume at least 3 cups of coffee and write, I write computer code typically for about maybe 4 or 5 hours until I hobble into my house and have any. Typically, my favorite thing is a one egg omelet with onions and mushrooms. Then I go and over to University of Bridgeport and get ready to either I teach or if I'm running a clinic shift, at which I usually eat an apple with a piece of peanut butter with that. But I'm type A, and that's not your blood type. And then basically dinner is, it could be any number of different things. I mean, I like most everything. Some things don't like me. I'm a pretty clear-cut person. I do take my own advice. I kind of wish I had given myself a better diet, you know, I would have liked if I had wound up with a high-protein diet. I would have been much happier. But yeah. I eat that stuff, and it just goes in all the wrong places.
Oh, no. Yeah, it's hard
my
for
wife
me because...
Mrs. Diadamo, on the other hand, is a typo. When she sits there with her roast beef and her lettuce roll, I mean, you know, it's...
it's frustrating. Well, for me, it's... I actually don't really like meat, but... you know, I went back to grass-fed beef after 27 years of not eating it about 2 years ago. And it was really funny because, you know, the first time I had it, you know, I had this all, you know, prepared. Oh my God, I'm going to be so sick. And, you know, my body doesn't know what to do with this. And I ate it and I was like, where's more? I was really like, the next day I was like, I want more. And I just, you know, was craving it. I do crave it now if I don't have it for a couple of days, but I don't love it.
Amy, look at what that first book said almost 25 years ago, that there are differences in people that, in terms of their digestive tract and their diet that are predictable by known genes. Okay, and we now call that personalized medicine, personalized nutrition. There are things in this world known as lectins, and they can be blood type specific. Well, now people are basically looking at blood types and lectins and stuff. There are things having to do with the internal environment in your biome that are specific to who you are. So now we've got a microbiome. There was the first book, mass market book, to ever tell anybody there was such a thing in this world called a grass-fed beef. It was the first book to mention that the most common way you make a GMO is to take a gene for a lectin in one species and put it in another. It's the first book to mention GMOs back then. Okay, so there was a lot of things in that first book that 20 years later, they became virtually common knowledge and common everyday conversations. But they were first mentioned in that book. And I defy many people, go find a book written in the early 1990s that mentioned those things.
No, I mean, you're definitely ahead of your time, right? I mean, I think the sign of, you know, somebody, you know, we were, you know, talking about, you know, why I hadn't seen you at functional medicine conferences and you hadn't felt embraced by that community. And, you know, I think the sign of, you know, sort of being an outsider is that you're ahead of your time, right? It maybe threatens people. I don't know.
That's true. But, you know, I also, as I get older, I don't enjoy traveling as much as I used to.
Yeah. Well, I certainly would love to meet you in person and have enjoyed this conversation, and hopefully our paths will cross, and I will forward you that email about the 23andMe.
Great. Well, thanks for having me, Amy.
Yeah, thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It was such an interesting conversation, and yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you. I'll talk to you later.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.
To stay in touch with Dr. Myers, you can sign up for her newsletter on her website at dramymyers.com or connect with her on Facebook or Twitter at Amy Myers MD.